Hi, this is Laura Savage, and you're listening to Endeavors.
That was Laura Sauvage with Alien, the single off her brand new album, The Beautiful. Well, the typewriter. Some might consider it a relic. Others, an ancient beauty and unique art piece. For Doug Nickel and Martin Howard, they definitely fall into the latter category. Martin Howard is an avid typewriter enthusiast and collector who currently owns around 50 instruments. But his collection goes even further and focuses on a specific time period. And him and his typewriters are featured in the great new documentary California Typewriter, which also features Tom Hanks, John Mayer, and the late Sam Shepard, and which was directed by Doug Nichol. Both Doug and Martin joined me last week, just prior to the film's opening, to talk about the film and the beauty of typewriters. Well, I'm here with Doug Nichol and Martin Howard from California Typewriter. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome to Toronto.
Hi, pleasure how to are meet you?
So, Doug, this film is quite interesting. You're the director of this film. How did this story first come to you? Why did you decide to tell a story about the great typewriter?
Well, it came to me totally by chance, because I direct commercials and music videos, and I bought on eBay an Underwood 5 typewriter, just as an object of art to set in my office, you know, a cool thing in the corner. And it sat there for a while, and then I felt, you know, the thing was almost like it was calling out to me every time to go push the keys, and I'd push them, and I felt like it wanted to be fixed up, you know. So I looked around, I couldn't find any typewriter shops left, and I finally found one in the Bay Area, like in Berkeley. Took it over there, walked in the shop, and I met these people, this family who were trying to keep their little typewriter shop open amongst, you know, San Francisco, which is the high-tech capital of the world. And I just thought it'd make a really interesting little short about these people trying against all odds to keep the typewriter going. So that's how it began.
And Martin, you're an avid typewriter aficionado.
I am.
And, you know, Doug kind of touched on the fact that there's still a lot of interest in them. We've seen a resurgence, but in many cases they're, you know, an art piece rather than actual, for a lot of people, rather than actual a functional piece of equipment. What was the appeal for you? How did you get into collecting this piece of technology?
Well, you're right. The 19th century typewriters, and 20th century typewriters for that matter, are exceptional examples of industrial design for that period. I like to refer to them as industrial art, you know. So I collect from the 1880s and 1890s. That's the period of the world's first typewriters, defined by the fact that the standard had not been set yet for what would be the standard design for the 20th century. So what got me going? Well, most of us enjoy and love old machinery one way or another, and I was no exception. And I was influenced by my parents, who collected all sorts of vintage tools and hung them on the basement wall. Medical tools, kitchen implements, farming implements, and I thought that was pretty cool. Grew an appreciation for that. How they were built, the quality, the beauty of these tools. As many of them, or some of them, are quite mysterious in what their function was. So in my late 20s, I decided I needed to figure out what I was going to collect, and I gave myself this criteria. It was going to be something from the 19th century that was mechanical, something not too large, something with great variety in design, and finally, something not collected by too many others, because I wanted to get my treasure at a good price. And I found this 2 years later in an antique shop, a very early typewriter from the 1880s, and therein began my collection.
We've seen a lot of millennials, I think, embrace the typewriter, not so much as a writing tool, but just, you know, like you said, for that vintage quality. A similar thing is vinyl. We've sort of seen vinyl make a comeback as well. What do you think it is that about this generation that we're sort of rediscovering our love of old tools? Why do you think that is?
Well, it's because most millennials have grown up in the digital era. So everyone who's grown up, you know, with digital cameras, digital video, iPads, you know, touching glass, you know.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are finding it cool to actually push a button and see what happens. Because, you know, when you touch your iPhone or computer, you push a key and you don't really know how it works. You know, like a character might appear, or some little game piece or whatever, but you can't see. And You know, when you use a typewriter, it's like you push the key and you can see the result of your action. When you use vinyl, you can put the record and you can see the grooves. You know, when you load film, you can see that. And I think it's actually just it's discovering something that you didn't know before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's well put, Doug. It's a discovery for those under the age of 30, perhaps, in a general sense, who didn't experience these, shall we say, analog tools, tools that have dimension and tactile sense and have a sound and a feel to them. So, yes, the vinyl records, record players for vinyl records, typewriters. What else is coming back? I suppose film, roll film into cameras, I suppose.
I think it's just the tactile things that
are coming back. Yeah, I think you're right, Doug. Yeah. It's tactile. It's hands-on as opposed to a two-dimensional touch screen.
And I think people are feeling that analog is different, you know? Because there's a warmth of the sound in analog that you don't get with digital. And there's, you know, even in photography, that if you shoot on film, it's still a lot better. You know, captures the whites better than digital.
And I must say, that's with the typewriter, there's also that added, perhaps, sensualness to it, perhaps, because as you type, you see movement, you hear sound, you the sound of the keys, the sound of the type bars hitting the paper, bang, 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 the characters appear right as you push the key. You don't have to wait and print it. It's happening in the moment. The sound of the bell as you push the carriage back. These are all exciting things. And in using a typewriter, it's sort of, I like to equate it like, you know, you're chiseling out a piece of wood with a hammer and chisel. It's a different tool than a computer keyboard. It's kind of magic in a way.
I think it was John Mayer that said in the video that typewriters don't judge. Do you find that using a typewriter, I feel like it might be a much more personal and intimate experience rather than using a computer. Was that the sense that you got?
Well, I mean, why John said that in the piece that he's in, it's like when you're using a computer, you know, like for him, he's trying to get the thoughts out of his head, like ideas for songs and stuff right onto a piece of paper, right? So he'll be writing, and then all at once, if a squiggly line appears, like spell check pops up that he's spelled a word wrong, he's going to feel, oh, damn, I got to go back and fix that word and re-spell it correctly. And that throws off the flow, you know, of ideas. And I think what he likes about a typewriter is he can sit down, all of his ideas come out without even thinking, you know what I mean? And then later he can go back and fix the spelling and stuff.
A stream of consciousness. He gets to let it all out, and as Doug said in the film, you know, he likes to, as he says, be a wacko. Just let the thoughts come out and not be interrupted by a computer. I mean, the squiggly line for an error. You might have a sound telling you you received an email. All sorts of interruptions on a computer, but with a typewriter, you are alone with your machine.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was growing up, when I was really young, I remember, you know, the old, like, 1980s, early 1990s sort of box computers. And I'm curious, do you think that we'll sort of see that in 30 to 40 years from now, the computers sort of becoming the typewriter of the next generation or the next two generations?
No, I don't think so, because it's much like in typewriters, the early typewriters, for instance. Nobody who's into typewriters are using those. They're art pieces. They use the ones where the typewriter evolved to a certain point, you know what I mean? It's like John Mayer says in the film, like with his guitar, like the best guitar, these 1950s Stratocasters or whatever, that the guitar never really, you know, mostly, some of the best guitars are, you know, 1950s. So, you know, once it reaches a certain level of evolution, that's what people like using.
That's a great answer, Doug, because I was stuck on that. I thought it was a great question you asked, Dan, and Doug hit the nail on the head there. The typewriter from the mid-20th century, 20s to the 70s perhaps, is the best example of the tool of the typewriter as a functional typing machine. And you're right, Doug. I mean, the computers from the 1980s and 90s that you refer to, Dan, they won't be the best possible tool in 30 years. What would be the best possible tool? I suppose what we're using now would be the furthest, would be fully functional, but still retro. So the Macs and PCs of today will be what people will use in 30 years' time.
In 30 years' time, when everyone just has a chip implanted in their head, they'll say, hey, man, I actually want to use an iPad. Isn't that cool? You know?
Yeah, that's right. It'll be an iPad, won't it?
Yeah, I want to do something physical. I don't want to... just like think my thoughts. I want to actually write them.
That's brilliant.
It also strikes me that there's something artistic about a typewriter that's not present in a computer. You know, like if I go in and buy a laptop or a desktop, there's basically three colors. You know, there's gray, there's black, maybe there's white, maybe there's a dark blue. But with typewriters, there's so much more than that. Freebarn was that part of the appeal, not only the mechanical side of things, but also this very artistic, picturesque side of things.
Absolutely, Dan. And given I collect from the 20th century, I mean, I've got to say that there's, you know how they say there's 1,000 designs for a mousetrap? The same is true for typewriters. All sorts of ingenious, crazy ideas, glorious successes and many failures. So really interesting design. So for me, it's the approach to create a machine to put the typewritten word on paper, the remarkable range of ideas. So it's the ingenuity of doing that really captivates me with the early typewriters. But I think, sorry, you were talking more about the design aesthetic, weren't you?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to spin it to the ingenuity of the design, how it actually achieves the goal. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing I will say just about this whole film, because we're talking about the film, a lot of people, in a way, focus on the typewriter, you know, but the film really isn't about typewriters, if you actually see it. It's really about something else. It's about a feeling about how things disappear in life and whether you look forward or backwards. That for me, that's what the film was, and I used typewriters in a way to tell that story.
Well, I was just going to bring up the fact that in a way, I think your film was both a time capsule and a way of linking the past and the present together through this medium of the typewriter. Was that something that sort of played into your mind at all, the different almost time periods?
Well, for me, the film, it was really about people. It wasn't about the machine at all. I made it about this family, this African-American family in Berkeley, who were just trying to survive. They were, you know, just trying to put food on the table, still repairing typewriters. And then I met Martin, who's preserving the past with, you know, in these amazing machines. And I met Jeremy Mayer, who's focused on the future. He destroys typewriters and turns them into sculptures that are symbols of how he sees us becoming eventual, like androids, you know, half part machine, part man. So for me, the thing was always about people, and it's about how we, you know, the feeling when things disappear, it's a bit of a melancholy, slight sadness, and then when you're looking to the future, it's a different kind of feeling. So it was about, for me, creating that feeling and about how people are.
So the typewriter was a metaphor of our technological change, about what we gain and what we lose in the illusion of gain. There's a lot of loss that perhaps we don't realize because we're under the illusion, and it's beautifully shown in the film. Doug shows all sorts of, he shows the, it's at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, all these fancy new devices and all these virtual reality things that in a way are striving to create what's naturally around us anyway. It's to create the real world virtually, and it's quite profound aspect of the movie is that in our strive to connect more with other people, what are we losing in our connections?
One of the other people that appears in the film is Tom Hanks, and he's well known as, he's probably the most famous typewriter enthusiast out there, I would argue. How'd you get him to come aboard and agree to be interviewed?
Well, when I made the short film, I made a 3-minute short about this family. Basically, I was just trying to help them out, put it on YouTube to get them some customers, you know, put it on my commercials reel. And then a friend got it to him through his wife, because a friend of mine was working on a script with his wife. And he saw it, he said, hey, I'll be interviewed, you know, he agreed. And then I thought, oh, it could be more than a short film, you know. And so once we got the interview with Tom, it just organically grew. I kept working on it, and then Tom led to David McCullough, and then to Sam Shepard and John Mayer, and it went to all these people I discovered, you know, this world.
You've gone well beyond the confines of that Berkeley, California typewriter shop, right?
Exactly. But they always remained the heart of the film. That's why it's still called California Typewriter.
I think Tom Hanks said he has 250 typewriters. Martin, how many do you currently own?
Thank you. It's always a nice question. It's an easy question to answer. I have 80 typewriters. And they're all from the 1880s and 1890s. So another response is not enough. You know, I always need more. But I have 80.
And you mentioned Sam Shepard, and we just lost him not too long ago. He was quite an artist. Interviewing him and sort of looking back on that now that he's gone, what was it like being in the same room with him?
Oh, that was a really special day. We went over to Santa Fe, and he was working at a place called the Santa Fe Institute, where it's mostly scientists, you know, like people working on nuclear, you know, astronomers, all kinds of amazing scientists. And they had two writers, which was Cormac McCarthy and Sam Shepard. And both those guys were working on there. They allowed them to be fellows at the Institute and work. So we went over and shot him. And it was just great, you know, spending, you know, several hours with him. He was in the midst of writing a play. So it was just nice to spend the day with him. He's a huge hero of mine. I always loved his plays and his acting.
I've got to say, it's one of the favorite parts, many favorite parts, but when Sam Shepard speaks in the film and reflects on his creative process with the typewriter and his creative process, beyond the typewriter, it always gets the hair on the back of my neck standing up. It's magic. Was that shot in his office? Was that in his home?
No, in the Santa Fe Institute.
It looked like it was a residential setting.
Yeah, it was just a library where he was working. No.
Well, the film is California Typewriter, and it opens tonight. Doug Nickel, Martin Howard, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan.
That was Martin Howard and Doug Nickel. Doug Nickel is the director of the documentary California Typewriter, which features collector Martin Howard. We're going to hear another song from Laura Sauvage off her album The Beautiful. This is Vegas.
Well, it barely rains in Nevada, and I've came here before. Hell, I'm never coming here anymore. I keep telling myself you don't learn from lies. Las Vegas Strip keeps burning my eyes, eager for dirty consolation prize. They keep winning, and we keep losing.
Vegas by Laura Sauvage off her new solo album, The Beautiful. Well, the idea for The Beautiful came during the last 3 years of being on the road with her band, Les Hay Babies. they were having success everywhere. Montreal, France, Switzerland, Germany, and Belgium, receiving multiple East Coast Music Award nominations and winning the French Songwriter of the Year Award at the Canadian Folk Music Awards. Les Hey Baby sings mostly in Shiak. They are from New Brunswick, and Laura herself is from a very small town just outside of Moncton in the east part of the province. With haunting vocals and signature guitar, The Beautiful lies somewhere between a stoner and a political record, featuring the surrealism of Pierre Cavalli with the DIY flair of the Parroquet Courts. It also features collaborators like Danny Placard, François Lafontaine, Nicolas Bedroin, and Les Hey Baby's acolytes, and as well as analog synths, a pinball, and a McDonald's. Basically, it's a dive into a zany 80s nerd paradise. Laura Sauvage was in town yesterday at the Burdock, and I spoke to her before the show about The Beautiful.
Good pronunciation.
Laura Sauvage, hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good, and you?
Good. It's getting a bit chilly here in Toronto. Are you finding it?
Yeah, big times.
So you have a new solo project out, The Beautiful. And I read that this thing started when you were on your last tour with your band. What made you decide that going solo was a project and a challenge you wanted to tackle?
Well, I've always been kind of inclined to write songs either with Hey Babies or not. And so I was just like accumulating a bunch of songs on my voice memos on my phone. And so Danny Placard, that plays with me on this project, he has like his own projects and stuff, and he proposed to record an EP. So we did an EP called Americana Submarine, and then he recorded an album that we got out later called Extraordinormal. And then but I always had the goal to eventually produce albums, because not a lot of women do it, and also it's just like a passion of mine that I wanted to achieve since I was like 12 years old. So yeah, I produced my last album, The Beautiful. And I think the goal was to you know, do it so often that I would be able to manage my own project.
Is there a difference in process for you from writing to the production of the album when you're a solo artist as opposed to a part of a bigger group?
Yes, because with Les Hey Babies, we have we call it the Hey Babies filter. So we're three writers. We're six musicians, but we're three writers. And anything we write, we make it go through the filter where, we do a lot of harmonies and stuff. And, like, we just try to make sure that everything lyric-wise is something that we're all comfortable saying. And, like, singing, because we all have, like, different accents, too, from different French towns and in New Brunswick. So we try to, like, bring it to a neutral ground where we're all comfortable. So it's really different doing my own stuff where I don't think twice. I just blurb out like a bunch of shit and it just becomes what it is.
I got to see the music video for, I guess, what's the single, Alien.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that track? Where did that come from?
Alien was, actually I tried to write a song about aliens for the last Hey Babies album. And I really wanted to write a song about my mom and my grandmother both like shared some witnesses or whatever, how do you say that, the témoignage, anyway, of
witnessing alien abductions.
Not abductions, but just the name of the song is like it's Alien, yeah. But it's more about UFOs, you know, it's unidentified flying objects, and like who knows if it's aliens or whatever, like, phenomenons that happens. But, like, so I kind of wanted to base it off of that because I find it kind of cool that my mom and my grandmother saw UFOs, and I hope one day I get to see one.
Are you a sci-fi fan?
I'm not like a huge like sci-fi fan, but it's like in the sense of like books and movies or, but I'm big into like reading on it and like watching documentaries about it, and I like science. I don't necessarily believe in I'm not into the fiction part of science.
The press notes I got for this said that The Beautiful lies somewhere between a stoner record and a political record.
Yeah.
So what's that medium for you?
Well, I kind of hate like saying like, oh, this is a political record, but it straight up is. It's about like right now, like the biggest criminal, well, one of the biggest criminals we have in this era. In the States, and it's been based out of that a lot, because when I was writing the record, I was reading a lot of like news and stuff, and like what was going on during the last campaign, and so I couldn't stop but write what I was feeling, because I was really, really angry that shit was happening. So yeah, it's a bit about that, and it's also very stoner in the sense of I was pretty much like stoned during the whole writing of it. So it falls well into the stoner political margin.
I know that you did a lot of writing sort of in hotel rooms in unfamiliar cities. What is it about that type of environment, the unknown, that creates inspiration for you?
Well, it's less about where I write it, and I think it's more about just having to write every day. And, like, wherever I am, like, I'm never going to stop writing because I'm somewhere else, you know? And I think it just makes it, you know, once you play the songs, you kind of think of another area that you wrote it in. You always remember, like, where you wrote the song in and, like, what setting or whatever. So I guess it just puts you back into that setting. Although with the last album, a lot of it was written, like, just in my old apartment. And, I moved since then. But it was, a lot of it during the recordings and stuff, like, I kind of got to touch that again because we went elsewhere for the recordings and stuff. We went to like two or three different spots.
And it also mentions how the album kind of becomes an 80s nerd paradise. What is your favorite 80s nerd thing?
It's weird because for the longest time I used to like hate 80s music and like couldn't listen to it. It would make my blood boil. And I started realizing that a lot of good music came from the 80s. And I'm not talking about, like, synths or whatever. I'm talking about, like, you know, like, Talking Heads or, like, Sonic Youth or whatever. And then I really got into this group or, like, this guy called Drab Majesty. And I discovered him in San Francisco, super random. And it was very gothic. And then because of that, like, I super tripped on the aesthetic of, like, that sound, you know? And so I kind of started, like, listening to more, like, proto-punk gothic stuff. And I also kind of warmed up to the thought of, you know, warming up to, like, sounds that I didn't usually like. And also discovering synths. Like, I'm not a keyboard or synth player myself, but I do now really love the sound of, like, all the different synths out there. So, yeah, so we decided to, like, fuck it, let's be cheesy and let's put those sounds in there.
Speaking of 80s, are you a Stranger Things fan?
I am, but I'm also a weird person where, like, any show, like, any series that I watch, I don't watch the last episode, so I feel like it goes on forever. So I haven't watched the last episode of the last season, well, the first season, and I haven't got into the second season yet because I'm waiting for my boyfriend to come back from Europe, and because I told him that I wouldn't start it without him.
And I know you were just in Europe touring a little bit. I think you were in Switzerland that you mentioned.
What's that experience like
for you, touring your own country versus anywhere else in the world?
Well, Europe, I've done it quite often, like with Hey Babies, and like we've been 4 times in Europe with Laura Savage this year, and like it's cool, but I find like I don't tour Canada as a whole enough, and so I can't really answer that question for that, but I definitely would appreciate touring Canada more, yeah, but I do appreciate Europe too.
And the venue tonight is very, very intimate and very quaint. What do you like about a venue like this?
Well, it's a challenge because like I usually play with a band, and I have to figure out like, you know, wing playing the songs alone. So just that by itself is kind of like taking over, but I like intimate settings because, like, I used to go see a lot of shows in intimate settings, and you know, every show is like special when you feel that you can just like not communicate with the person on stage, but the person on stage feels like they're communicating with you, and I kind of trip on that vibe, you know, it feels like they're talking to you, and I think it's gonna be cool, yeah. People can talk to me, just not heckle.
you're from the Maritimes, which might be the most musically rich and diverse part of our country. How much of the exposure to the Acadian culture influenced you in sort of your musical and in your creative life?
Well, it's two different answers for both bands. I find like with Hey Babies, it's way more touched with the Acadian culture. It's like, you know, because we sing mostly in Shiek, like the French and English language that we have. But this project, like the Laura Savage project, I find like it's not a cultural thing at all. It's really just like a like introspective outburst. It's more of, you know, I listen to a lot of music that's, like, not from Acadie, or it's not French, or it's not, you know, I listen to a lot of, like, Anglophone stuff, too, and I don't know, I find, like, it's, you know, this is my project, this is, but there's definitely influences of bands from back home that aren't necessarily Acadian. There's, like, a big, big underground scene in Moncton that's, like, totally worth checking out.
Would you say that you have a favorite track off of The Beautiful?
Oh, that's a tough question, because again, like the songs are always like associated to memories. So I find like, well, Alien was fun because it's very different from everything else on the album, and you know, like when Frank LaFontaine, the guy that was playing like the synths, came in, I saved that track for the last one because I know Frank, and I was like, this one he's gonna go all out, like I'm totally gonna let him like go all out and make a bunch of layers and like have fun with it. And it was also the first song on the album that we recorded like straight up during the week that we were recording, or the 2 weeks that we were recording. But I'm also very inclined to say You're Ugly When You Cry is another one that I kind of have I'm stuck on, because like we were just finishing a tour, and then we went to this studio called La Frette just outside of Paris, and it's crazy. It's like this big mansion that like Nick Cave recorded like one of his last albums there or whatever, and so we were just tripping out. Like my guitarist was a roadie for a band called Carquois from back home back in the day, and they recorded there, so just seeing him trip out and be able to actually play and record and not just be like the roadie for the guys kind of made me really happy about it too, and we had such a great time. So yeah, I hear it when we're playing it. Like, I hear and I see La Frette, so.
Well, the album is The Beautiful, and it's out now. Laura Sauvage, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
And now here's another song from The Beautiful. This is Hello, Hello. Well, my final two guests met and became friends on an Arctic journey from Iqaluit to Greenland. And they are now taking their friendship and putting it on stage at a new show at Buddies in Bad Times Theater called Kinalik, These Sharp Tools. The two artists in question are Inuk artist Lakuluk Williamson Bathory and queer theater maker Evelyn Perry, and they met on an Arctic expedition. Now they're sharing a stage, and these two powerful storytellers map new territory together in a work that gives voice and body to the histories culture, and climate we've inherited, and asks how we reckon with these sharp tools. In the Inuktitut language, when a knife is dull, it is said to have no face. The word kinalik translates to mean the knife is sharp, or it has a face. Embodying the stories of their heritage, Evelyn and Lakluk put a face to the colonial histories, power structures, and the changing climate that lie between them. It's a concert and a conversation. Kinalik is the meeting place of two people and the north and south of our country. It's on now until November 5th, and I spoke with Lakluk and Evelyn back on Tuesday.
I'm here with Evelyn Perry and Lakluk Williamson Bathory. Hello. How's
Hello.
It going?
Hello. Good.
Hello.
So you guys are right in the midst of a run of Kinalik. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Now, I read that this show started when the two of you met on an Arctic hike? Arctic exhibition? Expedition type of thing?
More than a hike. It was definitely more than a hike. It was a ship-based expedition. Began in Iqaluit and went to Greenland. And we were... it was an environmental education expedition. Students on ice... who do these large, there were 140 people on this ship, and we stopped in different places. And
How did this show come to me? You guys just, you met, you got to talking, and you just said, hey, let's make a show?
Yeah, we became friends on the ship, and as we... continued to talk, we realized that we have an awful lot of things in common, but an awful lot of things that are very disparate in our shared experience of being Canadians, women in Canada in the modern times. So we really wanted to be able to unpack all of those tremendous differences and share a story together.
A show like this, given the sort of the conversation that we're having in society about, reconciliation and trying to close that gap, if you will. What can a show like this do in terms of education, awareness, and, bringing the two communities together?
We're not really talking about reconciliation in our story. We're talking about showing each other ways of understanding, and that it is difficult and necessary and continuous. There's no end point.
Yeah, it was never a goal with the show to make a show about reconciliation.
No.
People may be interpreting it that way, which is awesome and whatever. People are interpreting, and the feedback we're getting, that a lot of people are learning a lot from the show, as you mentioned. But our intent was not educational. In a way, it was to have a chance to really... the chance to work together, and we didn't know what the show was going to be also. Mm-hmm. So we set out with some... I had some... Because for me, the experience in the Arctic when I met Lakluk was such a game changer for me of shifting my perspective on the country. It really shook me up very profoundly, which wasn't the experience for Lakluk. This is the part of the world that she lives in. And, we were having very different experiences on that same trip. Mm-hmm. But in speaking about it afterwards, it feels like it grew very gradually, idea of how we would try and approach what this might be, what this collaboration could be, and without trying to define it before it happened.
And I must say, a lot of feedback we've been getting from the Toronto crowd that it has been educational. But there's also been a lot of Inuit that have come to see the show, and they find it very relieving and opening, because it is all about telling personal stories. And that is so important to us as Inuit, that we come from a place where we have interconnected stories. It's not one grand explanation or representation of our people. It's all interconnected stories.
And in a way, through the show is kind of exploring story by story, like interlayering our stories sort of next to each other, on top of each other, seeing where they intersect and where they diverge and where they make meaning out of each other, and how they kind of, how our experience crashes up against each other sometimes in challenging ways, or ways that make either of us kind of like go, oh, I see something in a new way.
You sort of mentioned that, you know, when you first met, you didn't necessarily know what the show was going to be and how it was going to manifest itself. How, in terms of the development process of putting the show together, what was that like for the two of you?
It was pretty intense.
It was. It was also very important that everybody came to the Arctic, because I know the South. I've gone to university. I've grown up in the South, and it's a knowable thing for me, but it's not so immediately knowable for people that work here and live here. As Evelyn experienced on the ship, that even just the light, the taste of the air, everything is different. So it was a very important and beautiful time that we spent in Iqaluit, and very intense.
And it's been a very collaborative process. So it's the two of us, but also our director, Aaron Brubaker, and then Alicia Poirier, who's our live video person, and now Chris Dirksen as well on music, and Rebecca Pitrak on lights, and Caitlin Hickey on the set design, like all the elements. It's been a deeply collaborative affair. So it started with the four of us, the three from the South joining Iqaluit in Iqaluit, and then kind of finding the materials that we would work with over a couple of weeks, and generating, and that was generated by a lot of responding to each other, a lot of conversation, a lot of, like, there's one song that has wound up in the show that I created by watching a video that Iqaluit made of, that's a work that's not in the show, but through watching that video, I had a very strong response to it and wrote the lyrics that became a song. Like, it was trying to respond to each other's and to things we were identifying together as
common threads.
And things we wanted to put together.
To juxtapose and to contrast, but also to blend.
What sort of dynamic does music bring to a live show that maybe like a straight play wouldn't have, for example?
For me, I think part of what music, and it's not a musical in that sense, right? It's like, I mean, as we've sort of, the advertisement is a concert and a conversation, but trying to use music, for me, music like kind of express some things that can't be expressed otherwise, like gives gives an emotional access to feelings together with words. So it kind of allows, I think, part of what the play is exploring, to live in a space that's like physical and emotional, not intellectual.
That's right. Although it is also intellectual.
Yeah.
But it's important for us as women to be able to ground ourselves in that multifaceted way. It's not purely words. It's not purely music. It's not purely embodied emotions and stuff like that. It's working together. I think that's feminist way of doing things.
And, you know, Evelyn, I know that you're the artistic director here at Buddies, and I know that it's done a lot of good work in talking about different types of theater and different types of culture, and sort of using art as a way of bringing it together. What would you like to see happen in the future, as, you know, we're having bigger conversations on gender and sexuality? How do you think the arts can play a role in that discourse going forward?
I think they always have. And to me, think the arts are, and artists are always the people who are like dreaming the culture forward, seeing the next, like in touch with what's coming before everybody else is thinking about it. Like, it's like artists have some part of the special like spidey senses or like intuitions, ways of accessing kind of what's floating in the zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, what would I like to see? I would like to see more, especially in theater, more theaters taking risks to try out new things and new forms. And I think theater in Canada has, you know, it has a quite a short history and quite a colonial history. And only since the 70s have we even really been making, like, Canadian work that's even authored by people who've grown up here or living here. And we have such a diverse country with so many different perspectives in it. And like, that's part of the beauty, I think, of working on this project, is like being able to hold, like to say, like, these realities that we both live in are both Canada. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, to hold the vastness of what's contained here, and how do we express that in a new way? And I don't know, I think, to me, like, the way to express it in my own practice is usually about experiment, like finding a new way forward, try and figure out the form that's right for the project or this, the people, the artists. And this feels like, I mean, in a way it was a lot of unknown work and hard work, but in now that the work is formed, it feels almost inevitable of like, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
It was
yeah.
all of these threads that have woven together.
Uh-huh.
Because of who we are as artists and what are like the practices that we've brought together. And I guess it's also just like, you know, not worrying so much about like what's theater and what's not theater. Like, it's like yeah. let it breathe, let
what's
it
written,
live,
what's
let
unwritten.
It, yeah, let there be different ways of going about telling a story.
Yeah.
Maybe you can speak to it too, the same question of like what you think the future for. Well, there was a few questions in there. Actually, what was the question?
No, it was just, you know, how can the theater, you know, what kind of, what role will it play in the discourse when talking about issues such as gender and sexuality, which is what something that mm-hmm. Buddies has been doing for a long time.
Yeah.
For me, and being a part of a very strong Indigenous community, is that we have to interact with mainstream Canada, with non-Inuit, any people has to do that. But the way that we are having to do that is constantly explaining that our way of life is very different. In terms of unpicking all of those colonial stitches, saying, actually, we tell stories this way. Actually, this has always existed. Actually, this is continuous from time immemorial, and it is going to continue. There's no break in that. So from my perspective, theater is a practice that can really bring our stories, our words, our actual language into a state of perpetuation. Also creating a safe place where experimentation and collaboration and creativity is boundless. And also that, yeah, basically it's all about developing relationship between people on stage, backstage, and between the stage and the audience. That's so important for who we are and will continue to be.
Is there one thing you want the audience who comes sees this to take away from the show?
No. Not one thing. Like, there's so many layers to what it is that I think, yeah.
It is the antithesis.
We're not trying to deliver a message that's singular in some way. Like, we're trying to expose complexity and live inside of the complexity of this moment. And what has landed us in this moment and where we are and how we build relationships, I guess.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. What do we say? Let it be complex.
Yeah. I mean, I'm gratified that people seem to be really feeling a lot inside of the show.
Yeah.
And that I'm hearing people express learning things that they didn't know. So those always, to me, like, I'm like, those are signs of a successful theater show. If you're learning and feeling at the same time, that those two things are really good, profound experiences.
Well, the show is Kinalik, and it runs until Sunday here at Buddies in Bad Times Theater. Evelyn, Akuluk, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Lakluk Williamson Bathory and Evelyn Perry, and their show Kinalik, The Sharp Tools, is on now at Buddies in Bad Times Theater until November 5th. That's about it for this show. Taking you out with another song by Laura Sauvage. This is You're Ugly When You Cry. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.